Listening to The Sector, the radio show podcast discussing the world of nonprofits, social justice, and activism. My name is Ethan Clow, your host here on the show, and as always, we are broadcasting right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver on your radio dial, as well as streaming live at CITR.ca, and of course, by podcast, whenever, wherever, as technology permits. Well, I hope you're all enjoying your Friday morning. It is Friday, 8 a.m. here on CITR, and it looks to be a gorgeous day. Hopefully, we're going to get some high temperatures out there, but not too high. I mean, this is Canada, after all. We don't want it too hot out there. At least, I don't. Anyway, we have a fantastic show this week. Some big news, of course, in the social justice sort of progressive categories of politics. I'm sure you've heard of the stunning victory of the NDP in Alberta. Yes, that's right. Alberta has gone completely NDP. They've gone orange. So what does that mean? What does that mean for the energy industry? What does that mean for the oil and the sort of cowboy culture of Alberta? What's going to happen there? Are we going to see a dramatic shift? Well, I mean, who knows, right? The NDP aren't necessarily going to be the most culturally different in Alberta, but they certainly might bring some new changes to the energy table. And continuing on the politics vein, the controversial spy bill put forth by Stephen Harper's Conservatives has passed the House of Commons. We sort of knew it would. Of course, the Conservatives and the Liberals supporting the bill, the NDP and everybody else voting against it. So we're going to dive into a bit on that as well. What can we expect from this new invasion of privacy bill and what it means politically going forward? And I'm going to try to squeeze in some music on today's show. I like to put a bit more music in whenever we talk about politics. I find that that helps clear the palate a little bit after all that politicalness. Anyway, so we'll have some music a bit later on. So lots of fun stuff coming up on the show. Before we go to any of that, though, let's take a quick commercial break here on The Sector. We will return after this.
The federal government is trying to ram through a set of electronic surveillance laws that will invade your privacy and cost you money. The plan is to force every phone and internet provider to surrender our personal information to authorities without a warrant. The worst part of their invasive, all-encompassing surveillance scheme is that you have to pay for it out of your own pocket. Send Ottawa a message by signing the petition at stopspying.ca. That's www.stopspying.ca. Thank you.
A long time ago, in a city far, far away,
CITR
was born. In the decade ahead, America will be in space.
CITR
is already there. Astronaut Neil Armstrong had this to say about
CITR.
It's one small step for man.
So vote
CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Herbert R. Tarlick, Chairman.
And we are back here on The Sector with me, your host, Ethan Clow. Now, before we get into the heavy politics of the show, I wanted to just kind of quickly mention a bit of a controversy, or maybe, I don't know, a manufactured controversy, depending on how you look at it. But this came across my newsfeed a week or so ago, and I just found it very interesting, and I wanted to kind of discuss this. But as you know, Canada, the country, this one, was founded in 1867. So that means our 150th birthday is coming up on 2017. which is, you know, not that far away. So, as always, there'll be a big party celebration for Canada's 150th. And to do so, a special logo for Canada, I guess it will go on our all the promotional material for this big party, was announced. Now, apparently, this new logo, though, is not without some controversy. The logo design was announced a few years ago by the Department of Heritage, and they announced that they had been testing five potential logos with a focus group, which drew a bit of concern from the professional graphic designers of Canada, who felt that this was kind of circumventing their chosen field. So they actually created their own contest where you could submit a design, and they created a website to display it all, and a public relations company offered to put up $25,000 as a prize for the winning design. The government, perhaps as a response, or maybe, I don't know, they were caught off guard or something, they announced their own contest for post-secondary students with a $5,000 prize going to the design selected by a jury. Now, the fact that the government set up their own contest after the fact and set up a contest with a $5,000 prize as opposed to $25,000, and also pointed it at post-secondary students, I think rankled a few feathers, maybe. The fact that, again, sort of the collective, I guess it's not a union, but a collective group of graphic designers felt, hey, that's a little bit shady. This is our business here. Anyway, the fact that the prize was kind of small, and there also was the feeling that this was actually kind of shortchanging a lot of young designers who ultimately, you know, for them to be successful, they need to have their designs be paid a reasonable sum. And this was kind of a little bit exploitive, according to some people. But, you know, those sort of calls kind of fell away, and a new logo came out of the whole process, designed by Adriana Kuvin, who is a business global business and digital arts student at the University of Waterloo. Now, her design, well, I mean, it's not ugly, but certainly it hasn't drawn the most favorable reviews. For those of you who haven't seen the design, again, I wouldn't call it ugly or anything. It's basically a stylized Canadian leaf made up of geometric shapes, triangles, trapezoids, and whatnot. It's multicolored, blue, red, orange, orangey red, dark blue, yellow, purple, pink, green, and light green. And again, you know, it's not extraordinary. It's not extraordinarily ugly, in my opinion. But a few people have taken issue with it, saying that it's not up to par, and that could have something to do with the fact that it was designed by a student. According to the Ottawa Citizen, Kuvin's design was created in a matter of days and officially described as a series of diamonds arranged in the shape of a maple leaf, which evokes a sense of pride, unity, and celebration, and reflects Canada as a diverse nation with a rich past and a promising future. The Graphic Designers of Canada, the GDC, I never thought I'd say those words, the National Certification Body for Graphic Design and Communication Designers, is generally unimpressed with the process. They feel that the students were sort of exploited in this manner, and that it's not really fair from a business standpoint, but also not really fair in terms of, you know, the growth of an artist type thing. Now, of course, I mean, all of this is relatively silly to get this worked up over a logo, and I don't think anyone really honestly is that worked up over it. But it is actually kind of fitting, I think, in an odd sort of way that this is something that we would get worked up over. You know, actually, this kind of reminds me of the whole celebration around the War of 1812, which I guess was 3 years ago or something. For those of you who don't know, the government of Canada, the Conservative government of Canada, that is, wanted to create a big deal about the War of 1812. And for those of you who, like me, have kind of studied history and know a bit about the War of 1812, know that the War of 1812 was really a dumb war. It's a footnote in history. It is a war fought between two powerful nations that Canada was not either of those. it was kind of this manufactured, really, in a very kind of like propaganda-y way, display about Canada's role in this conflict. And even the marketing of it was inaccurate. It really sort of cast this very strange light on Canadian identity, and really when it went, I think, against the grain of accepted scholarly interpretations of the war as to what it meant for the people who lived in, you know, at the time, Upper and Lower Canada. So, you know, it's interesting that we're already kind of seeing something a little bit similar developing for Canada's 150th. What will that effect have on the celebrations and the tone of those? It remains to be seen. I mean, we may have a different government by the time that that comes along. What's interesting, of course, is that, you know, what we're learning about in terms of Canada and its growth as a nation and our history is that we don't exactly have this sort of rosy background that we maybe wanted to have. We're becoming a bit more aware of Canada's troubled past in terms of its treatment of First Nations, in terms of our treatment of immigrants, in terms of, you know, how the promise of Canada hasn't exactly panned out for every Canadian. And, you know, again, when you're having a big party, you don't necessarily want to have a big, you know, downer moment and go, ugh. But at the same time, you also don't want to necessarily sweep the problems under the rug and pretend like we're having this great, big, amazing country. When there are a lot of things that could be fixed and done better, it can just come across as insulting. So let's keep our eye on the 150th and see how this develops and where this goes. Maybe we'll see a bit more of a introspective Canadian celebration as opposed to kind of a rah-rah, we're so great type of celebration. But speaking of celebrations, there was a big one in Alberta the other day. And yes, that was an awesome segue, by the way. The big celebration in Alberta as the NDP skyrocketed to a majority provincial government. An amazement, a feat that had never been accomplished before and has left many absolutely shocked, astounded, and flabbergasted. All of those things have happened. Now you might say, what's the big deal with a province in Canada electing a new provincial government? Well, this is Alberta, largely considered Canada's Texas, electing the leftist-leaning party in Canadian politics, well, I mean, by most standards. Alberta NDP leader Rachel Notley becoming the premier after her party winning a majority government in Alberta earlier this week. It's quite shocking, really. Now, what's interesting, of course, about this is the political history of Alberta is so unique and so bizarre that this does lead to a lot of just kind of examination of what is happening to the province. To give you an idea, for those of you who don't know a bit about Alberta's political history, this is a province that elects dynasties, not political parties. To expand on that idea, I want to give you a bit of a rundown of how Alberta has voted in the past 100 years. And you might think, okay, this is going to be a very long list. No, it's not. It's going to be a list with five parties on it. From 1905 to 1921, Alberta elected the Alberta Liberal Party. Now, the Liberal Party of Alberta is a bit different from, say, the BC Liberals. They are, well, they're both a centrist party, but I would probably say the Alberta Liberals might be even actually a bit more left of center, perhaps a little tiny bit. I'm not an expert on, you know, Albertan politics in that respect, so maybe someone can correct me if I'm wrong. But yeah, they're sort of a centrist party. So that lasted, keep in mind, they were in power from 1905 to 1921. They were swept from the legislature by the United Farmers of Alberta in 1921, and they lasted until 1935. Now, the United Farmers were definitely a left-leaning progressive group. And keep in mind that this was still pre-30s. So we're talking 1930s kind of cooperative, commonwealth-style progressive. They focused on things like social democracy, healthcare, protecting farmers' rights, making sure that labor rights and taxation was fair, focused on electoral reform. They formed the Alberta Wheat Pool and ended prohibition. So, I mean, there you go. And again, kind of sort of a precursor to the NDP in some respects, but again, markably left shift for Alberta politics. Now, after the United Farmers of Alberta lost power in 1935, the Social Credit Party of Alberta took power in 35 and lasted till 1971. So, again, a very long time in power. And as I was mentioning before, this is about electing dynasties here in Alberta. Now, the Social Credit Party is definitely a swing to what we would identify as a right-wing political party, focusing on conservatism, social credit, which was a monetary system I'm not going to get into, it's complicated and silly, and definitely Christian social values. Again, you can kind of think of sort of the Bible-thumping, gin and tonic-drinking Christian identity of the 1930s, and of course, you know, moving through the post-war period, that kind of ideology really was popular in a lot of agrarian parts of Canada as well as America. The Social Credit Party even was in BC for a while. So this is, much more traditional right-wing politics, and again, really set the base for a lot of Alberta's future political identity. Very Christian and very focused on a kind of a conservative social value of society and life and everything like that. Now, the Social Credit Party held sway until 1971, really, really long time. Then, of course, the Alberta Progressive Conservatives took power in 71 all the way up to 2015. Now, there's a bit of an interesting difference between the Progressive Conservatives and the Social Credit Party. Both of them are conservative right-wing parties, but the Progressive Conservatives, you could say, are more urban, whereas the Social Credit would be more rural. It's the difference between kind of a Bible-thumping farmer's mentality versus a more kind of business-focused conservative values mentality. And, you know, the Progressive Conservatives had their own kind of unique history in terms of, for a time, they sort of merged with the Liberal Party and then separated, and now they sort of became their own dominant force in the sort of late 60s, forming a government in the 70s, and again, lasting for about 44 years in power. So not only was this obviously a very long time, but this is actually the longest unbroken run in government at the provincial or federal level in Canadian history. So no government in Canada, provincial or federal or otherwise, has lasted, stayed in power at 44 years. Again, we're talking about dynasties here, people. These political parties have maintained power for year after year after year, unchallenged in any meaningful way. So again, you have this Progressive Conservative Party, which has been in power for a very long time, more of the time than anyone ever could possibly imagine. And it has been representing Alberta's values for a very, very long time. Nobody expected them to lose. In fact, the biggest sort of discussion was, would Alberta go Liberal? Would Alberta switch maybe to a different kind of the Wild Rose Party? Which, for those of you who don't know, the Wild Rose is also a conservative center-right political party, not surprising. And their big breakthrough came in, I guess, the late 2000s. And in the 2012 election, the party failed to have a breakout that a lot of media predicted. There was a lot of unsatisfaction with the Progressive Conservatives, and they thought that the Wild Rose would be the ones to sweep in and sort of take their place. Again, you know, a fiscal conservative, social conservative party. There's been perhaps unfair comparisons to the Tea Party, but no, I think that the Wild Rose is probably just another kind of vein of typical Alberta conservatism. Now, what's surprising, of course, is that in this election, people thought, okay, well, surely the Wild Rose would do better and may even, in fact, win. Of course, they did not. What I find interesting in looking at a lot of the media response to the NDP victory is just really how surprised everybody is, despite the fact that the NDP were leading in the polls for a few weeks before the election. Now, I want to actually quote from an article that I was reading on the CBC by Kathleen Petty. And just to give you an idea of sort of what this is like in Alberta. Usually, autopsies aren't done when there's life left in the corpse. But in politics, when you've been drawn and quartered by the electorate, it is a mercy to get on with it. And Premier Jim Prentice was right to resign immediately, as he did last night. Remember, when you lose government in Alberta, you're done, finished, kaput. No defeated government party has ever been a political force again. So those are, you know, shockingly damning words when it comes to politics in Alberta. Is this the end of the Progressive Conservatives? Maybe, maybe not. Well, you know, history has a way of balancing itself out, actually. But it is kind of interesting to look at the idea that this could signal a whole new turn in what has long been, you know, believed to be the conservative heartland of Canada. And, you know, again, to look at sort of the architecture of the fall of the PCs in Alberta, there's a lot of different factors here, of course, but the budget, the taxation of everybody except corporations, the endorsements from business people and oil industry, and a lot of, you know, Toronto-based ownership of that, I think played to a lot of the nationalism of Albertans, and also the reality of triggering that, hey, this is a have province. Why are we footing the bill when these big industries are not? Ultimately, that sort of promise of higher corporate taxation under the NDP seemed to a lot of people, hey, this is actually a pretty good idea. Let's try that out. So again, it's not so much that we're going to see, you know, a hippie Alberta, but it does actually strike us that if you can win over a conservative support base like this and say, look, you're paying taxes when the richest people in this country are not, that means something to people. Now, what effect this will have federally remains to be seen, but it certainly can't be good for Stephen Harper's conservatives when this province turns around and says, you know what, we're not happy with this tax structure. Now, I want to play a quick clip of the Alberta Premier, Rachel Notley, talking about the Northern Gateway Pipeline. This is a clip come courtesy of the Edmonton Journal and the Calgary Herald, and I'm just going to play it. It's only about a minute long, and just have a listen to what the new Premier, the NDP Premier of Alberta, has to say about the Northern Gateway Pipeline.
As I've said, my position on the Keystone is not necessarily that I'm opposed to the Keystone. What I'm opposed to is what's going down it under the current model. And what's the current model is that what goes down that pipeline is jobs. Thousands and thousands of jobs are going to Texas. That's what is going on in that pipeline. And so I would want to sort of rethink whether that's priority number one. Now, as Premier, in terms of working with other Premiers and working with other jurisdictions, I think there is a role to play there.
What would you do on Gateway?
I think Gateway is not the right decision. I think there's just too much environmental sensitivity there, and I think there's genuine concerns by the Indigenous communities. But I also think from an environmental point of view, it's a problem, and I think BC's made itself very clear on that. And so I don't think it's a particularly good use of our time. I think Kinder Morgan continues to be worthy of discussion because the route there has been established and has been fairly effective. But I don't see, pardon me?
Energy
use is also is another one that I think we need to talk to people about and work on. Absolutely, I think there's potential there.
So you would not endorse or press for approval of Northern Gateway where you're the Premier?
I don't think there's any point to it. I think that the legal and the environmental implications are such that it's not going to go ahead. I think most people know that.
And so that's just a small sample, again, you know, early statements, but something to go on in terms of what her policy is going to be on energy. Again, I mean, it's a bit troubling that she's still kind of on this whole Kinder Morgan thing, but nevertheless, it does give us a bit of an insight that she's not going to cave in to oil pressure. At the very least, we have some promising first starts there. Well, enough of Alberta politics. We're going to take a quick break here on The Sector. However, before that, I want to play some music for you as promised. Now, I got a couple songs here off of the album Lazaretto by Jack White, which was new as of 2014. And so the first song that I'm going to play is Just One Drink by Jack White, of course. And the next one is an instrumental track called Highball Stepper. Let's have a listen.
You drink water, I drink gasoline. One of us is happy, one of us is mean. I love you, but honey, why don't you love me? Yeah, well, I love you, but honey, why don't you love me?
all know that the word jazz means many different things to many different people. So check out The Real Deal on The Jazz Show at CITR 101.9 FM or CITR.ca for live streaming. Yours truly, Gavin Walker, is your host, and I guarantee the straight goods of 3 hours of jazz at its finest. So come on by and give your ears a musical workout, 9 p.m. Mondays. Don't miss it.
Whoever said money can't buy you friends obviously wasn't a member at CITR. When you become a member, you get the Friends of CITR card with incredible discounts in the downtown area at
The Baker and the Chef, Bang On T-shirts, Beat Street Records, Dunlevy Snack Bar, The Fall Tattooing, Fortune Sound Club, Hits Boutique, Pacific Cinematheque, Perch, The Portside Pub, Save On Meats, and Vinyl Records.
To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus or go online to citr.ca.
Class, shut up! Shut up and listen to me right now. This is Fred Schneider and you're listening to CITR. Shut up and listen to this radio station.
We are back on The Sector, the radio show podcast discussing the world of nonprofit, social justice, and activism. And I am your host, Ethan Clow, and we've been discussing the political situation in Alberta, a dramatic shift for progressive politics, changing the game, changing the landscape. It's a season of change. I can't think of any more change analogies, whatever. Okay, well, we're back on the show. Before the break, I played for you a couple songs. The first one was Just One Drink by Jack White off his new album, Lazaretto, as in new, as in was published in 2014, and then followed it up with Highball Stepper, which was a instrumental track, a very unique sounding song. I really like it. Anyway, we're back here on the show. Still lots to discuss in the political arena, but before we get to that, there was something that I've heard on the social medias, and it's a bit of a kind of a clarification, because there was this viral story going around about men with beards. And as some of you know, I am at some times a man with a beard. So I wanted to clarify this news story, and thankfully the social media has caught up to it. So just to quickly clarify and expand upon what has already been said, let's summarize the whole situation. So basically, social media got caught up in a news story in the last few weeks suggesting that beards harbor dangerous germs. In fact, that if you were to swab the beards of men, you would find that they, in fact, harbor more germs than your average run-of-the-mill toilet. So, yes, as you can imagine, something like this is bound to go viral, no pun intended, and got shared around on social media a lot, and I found it mildly amusing for a little bit. Of course, it's simply not true. To quote from an article on Slate about this story subject, quote, this story hits almost all of the sweet spots of the genre. It has no actual data, no controls, nonsensical interpretation of the results, such as they are, and a punchline that can be summed up in 140 characters or fewer. So, yeah, when you get one of these viral stories that are too good to be true, they probably are. Now, the initial, quote, study, what they did is they swapped some beards, sent them off to a company for analysis, and what they got back, the report indicated that beards contained, you know, germs, which, again, not surprising, right? Germs are everywhere. But specifically, enteric bacteria, which are part of the human gut microbiome, and therefore, you know, found in feces. So, therefore, your beard is as dirty as a toilet, or beards contain poop. Now, a bit of scientific background, of course, helps us understand this is not exactly the case. What it boils down to, of course, is if you were to swab anybody, you would find bacteria on them. In fact, everything in every surface, everything that we touch has bacteria on it. Most of it is harmless. In fact, most of it just sort of makes up the background biodiversity of microscopic life forms everywhere. If you were to swab any other part of the bodies of those men that they swabbed, you would find bacteria. What would be helpful, or at least illuminating, is if we knew if whether or not people with beards have more bacteria than people without beards. But fortunately, that actually has been studied. A study looked at the bacterial ecology of hospital workers with facial hair. And what they were able to conclude is that healthcare workers with and without beards harbored similar amounts of bacteria. So that means, more or less, a beard is not going to make you cleaner or dirtier in that sense. Now, we should point out that the gut bacteria that so often is assumed to be best buddies with, you know, feces, is a bit of a misnomer. The gut bacteria is indeed a lot of places, but it doesn't necessarily mean that just because it's also in feces means that there is feces on your face. Basically, what it comes down to is that there are certain types of bacteria that are beneficial and necessary for human survival around us. It has to be on things that we touch and gets inside of us because it does good things. To make the claim that because you have bacteria that also exists in feces on you, therefore you have feces on you, is sort of like saying if you have cat hair on you, that means you're likely to be eaten by a lion. It's just not true. It's a bit of a hyperbole. So again, to recap, this story, which went viral, not really true. Do stop sharing it. And also, of course, if you are growing a beard, make sure that you take good care of it by washing it and sculpting it and massaging it and use some conditioner. I find that helps. It keeps it from being really itchy. And the worst thing in the world is an itchy beard, as I can personally attest to. I also would recommend getting a good electric razor and a trimmer just to kind of go around the edges and keep the neckline nice and clean. I don't know why I'm talking about this in so much detail. Anyway, let's move on to the next big story here on The Sector. On a previous episode, we talked a bit about the oil spill that occurred off the coast of BC. And one of the things that complicated the cleanup that goes on to this day is the closing of the Vancouver Coast Guard. The closing of which was budgeted for by Stephen Harper's Conservatives when they decided that it was, you know, too much of a drain on the pocketbook to keep a Coast Guard facility in the Vancouver area. When the oil spill happened and there wasn't enough resources to help with the cleanup and the taking care of the coastline, a lot of people kind of justifiably said, maybe that was a really stupid, bad decision by the Conservatives. We should have voted differently last time in the election. Well, guess what? Another one is being closed. The Canadian Coast Guard facility in Vancouver is closing the Marine Communications and Traffic Center, meaning marine traffic for the region will be managed from a center in Victoria. The union director, Gavin McGergel, questioned how the system will work without the center overlooking the region from its base atop a commercial tower at 55 West Hastings Street, overlooking the Burrard Inlet in English Bay. He is quoted as saying, "As we say to people who live in Vancouver, how would you like to land at the airport and know that your control tower was based in Victoria?" Exactly. I think that that's a pretty good point. It also kind of raises the question of, you know, there was an oil spill just recently. Why are we closing down another facility that helps coordinate the response to cleaning this up? Nevertheless, it's happening. So keep in mind that since 2012, this reorganization of the Coast Guard, including the controversial closure of the Kitsilano one, also means that that 10 marine communication centers across the country, including this one, will be closed. The idea is that they're going to upgrade the remaining 12 to manage wider areas. Now, whether or not that is more effective or cost-effective remains to be seen. The question, of course, really comes down to, well, we've already seen the effectiveness, in quotation marks, of closing one Coast Guard when a marine disaster happens. Can we really trust that based on this sort of budget string-clenching endeavor that by enhancing a bunch of other communication centers to cover a wider area, is that going to be as effective? What if it shuts down? What if there's a problem? What are the backup procedures? You know, it does raise a lot of concerning issues related to protecting the coast. It also raises the question, if you are planning on shipping oil down a coastline, don't you want more Coast Guard facilities in the area, not less? Don't you want more communication hubs, not less? It does seem to be rather short-sighted and oddly, you know, counterintuitive to reduce the amount of communication and rescue forces around the area, especially when the potential is for it to become a high traffic shipping lane. I mean, more so than Vancouver already is. Now we're talking about having oil, potentially volatile substance, moving up and down our coast, and we're looking at using less resources to track, maintain, and ensure safety. That doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. And again, to kind of wrap this into our policy here on the sector of promoting progressive politics, it seems like a very irrational decision. And when, you know, policymakers are making irrational decisions, it's probably because they haven't really given a lot of thought to the issue at hand. And if they're not going to do that, then maybe it's more important for us as an informed elector base to keep that in mind the next time we go to the polls. Because if they're not going to make rational decisions about our welfare locally, it kind of, you know, stands to reason that they're not very good politicians. They're not looking out for our interests. So just a thought to put in the heads of everybody who is listening right now on the sector. And again, if you have any thoughts you'd like to share with us, perhaps about the closure of the Coast Guard facilities in Vancouver area, or just in general here on the show, any ideas or thoughts or topics you'd like to discuss, you can email us at sectorpodcast@gmail.com. You can visit us online at our website, sectorpodcast.wordpress.com. There you will find all of our podcast links, as well as show notes and information for more further research that you can do on your own time. You can also tweet us. You can tweet at Sector Podcast or tweet at Ethan Clow. Obviously, that's me on Twitter, as well as visiting our Facebook page at facebook.com/sectorpodcast. And we do appreciate any shares or retweets that you can give us. We really do. Help us get the word out. And of course, by us, I don't just mean me, but also the good folks here at CITR. And again, visit CITR.ca to subscribe to the podcast, as well as stream live radio content, not just the sector, but any other show. Great service. We have a brand new website coming soon, as well as a new location here on the UBC campus. Well, let's take one quick final commercial break here on the show. We will return after this.
UBC's Museum of Anthropology displays long-term and visiting exhibits of Indigenous art from around the world, and guided tours are free. Our permanent collection features one of the world's finest exhibits of Northwest Coast First Nations art. Our collection includes 36,000 ethnographic pieces, 535,000 archaeological pieces, and over 600 pieces in the Kroner Ceramics Gallery. There's a lot to take in. Luckily, at the Museum of Anthropology, final exams are always take-home. If you've never checked out this world-class facility, now's your chance. The Museum of Anthropology is located right on campus and free for all UBC students and faculty. Come enjoy our collection and resources.
Then there's the utter misery that is college radio, where they apparently just let any bewildered freshman wander into the booth and try to run a radio station. Campus Outreach is looking for... Hang on. College radio can pretty much be summed up in five words.
CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
And we are back here on The Sector. So, listeners, as you probably know, the controversial Bill C-51 has passed the House of Commons. Now, the C-51 bill, of course, is the anti-terrorism bill, or more accurately, the anti-privacy bill that has been the brainchild of Stephen Harper and the Conservatives since those tragic incidents on Parliament Hill last year. Now, Bill C-51, do not be fooled by its anti-terrorism wording. This is a very dangerous bill and severely alters the landscape of Canadian civil liberties as we know it. The fact that it passed the House of Commons is both shockingly disappointing and a little bit disturbing to see the support that Justin Trudeau has given this bill. You know, anyone who knows anything about Canadian history knows about Pierre Trudeau, Justin Trudeau's father, and his role in creating the Canadian Constitution, which, among other things, entrenched the Charter of Rights, bilingualism in Canada, and certain civil liberties that we now take for granted and which have been, unfortunately, trampled on. The fact that Justin Trudeau has so arrogantly and without really any careful thought or demonstrating any of the political will of his father has allowed that to happen is both, you know, it's sad, and it's also, I think, really telling as to the kind of character that he has. And that's really too bad. It's really unfortunate to see that sort of thing happening here in Canada. The fact that he has supported this bill is really a nail in the coffin that the federal Liberals are anything but. They are a center-right political party that shows very little regard for the hard-earned rights of Canadians to privacy and to the civil liberties that make this country unique. It's really quite tragic. Anyway, the effect of the bill, C-51, passing the House of Commons, will likely pass the Senate. Whether or not it ever goes up against the Supreme Court remains to be seen. Perhaps it'll be struck down. It's difficult to say. And again, I think we've already talked a bit about C-51 and what it can do. But just to keep in mind that this gives CSIS, which is sort of the Canadian version of like the FBI or the CIA, gives them a lot of secret police force, very little oversight or accountability. It opens the door to violations of charter rights, including censorship of free expression online, and it's effectively going to be ineffective in terms of protecting Canadians from terrorism. Most concerning, I think, is the notion that it's so vaguely worded and so vaguely written that if anything is deemed detrimental to Canadian freedoms, or if it's deemed to basically have any negative effect, and how that a negative effect is quantified is totally open to interpretation. If the government views a website or an article or anything as potentially un-Canadian or endangering to Canadian values. And again, what does that even mean? We don't know. This bill does not explain that. They have the legal right to shut it down. They can arrest people. They can arrest people and hold them much longer than they used to be able to without having the legal framework in place to justify that imprisonment. Again, this is very troubling material. It opens up the door to more spying on Canadian citizens. The same sort of thing that people like Edward Snowden had kind of cast a light on in America is now legally going to happen here in Canada. It also enables the Canadian government to do some fairly reckless spying overseas, which again has shown to be a lot more dangerous and harmful than I think in many ways has shown to be beneficial, especially in America. It not only drives away allies, but it also seems to foment the same kind of radical terrorism that it so, you know, hopes to stop. Additionally, a recent forum research poll cited by AFP has shown that only one-third of Canadians support these stepped-up national security measures, and the majority are against them. Now, that's pretty interesting. And it also goes into, I think, what we were talking about a bit earlier with Alberta. If you can have one of the most conservative parts of Canada go orange, you can certainly have the national country as a whole make a statement about something as drastically important as the security measures. And it's entirely possible that Stephen Harper and Justin Trudeau may find themselves punished by Canadian voters in a few months based on their support of this. Certainly, it has generated a lot of public conversations. Notable Canadians like Margaret Atwood has spoken out about this. A number of prominent Canadian media people have spoken out about this. It's been sort of trending on social media. People are tweeting at Liberal MPs. They are tweeting at Conservative MPs, informing them that voting in favor of this bill will cost them their support of the party. So it is a remarkable way that Canadians are letting the government know that we don't support this. Now, again, how will this affect the election coming up? We're not really sure yet. But if Alberta is an example, then it could indicate a very, a thorough changing of the guard, so to speak. Now, there's more to be said about this, of course, but as we are still in the very early stages of seeing how this is going to get implemented, both, you know, on a legal level here in Canada, I mean, after all, it's just passed the House of Commons. The Senate is coming up next. Will this, you know, find its way into the courts? I don't know. It depends on if there is ever a legal challenge put against it, which hopefully there will be. In the meantime, you know, we're going to have to keep our eyes on this. And as much as I'd like to kind of go on and on about it, we are running out of time here on The Sector. This has been a very politics-heavy episode, but that's okay. I think it's fun every now and then to kind of dive into the nitty-gritty and talk about, like, what kind of progressive politics we want to see and what actually is happening and, you know, where we kind of are on that that scale. Anyway, be sure to tune in next week for a new episode of The Sector. I'm hoping to have with us next couple of weeks some more interviews. So that should be a lot of pretty exciting stuff. Be sure to let me know if you have any suggestions for guests or topics that you want me to cover. And again, you can email us at sectorpodcast@gmail.com or tweet me at Ethan Clow on Twitter. More than happy to hear from you. Well, I'm going to wrap things up a bit early this week, as I actually have a plane to catch very soon. I guess so. This bill C-51 is going to be more relevant than ever. Hopefully, I'm getting on that plane before it passes officially. Whatever. I will be seeing you all next week, same time, same channel here on CITR. And I encourage you to stay tuned because coming up next is Up on the Roof. And, of course, there'll be a lot of great music and content on CITR today. Visit CITR.ca for more information on that. Well, this is Ethan Clow, your host on The Sector, saying thank you for listening. See you all next week. Have a fantastic weekend.